held over the amendments have issues and need to be adjusted. And 2110, same thing. The amendments were not written for an agreement, and those need to be adjusted. So anybody on 2110 or 2318 can come back Monday. We've got a huge bill here. 2646. Let's do a public hearing on that. Representative Williams.
Oh. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It is my pleasure to appear in front of you today on House Bill 2646. I'm Representative Max Williams. I represent House District 35. And to my right is Wendy Johnson, who is with the Oregon Law Commission, and to my left is a familiar face, Dave Hendricks, who from Legislative Counsel's Office, who spent a considerable amount of time assisting the Law Commission Judgment and Garnishment Work Group in drafting what is before you in House Bill 2646. And as I walked into the hearing room today, Mr. Chairman, I felt like I was stepping into a sea of nervous anticipation. I'm pleased to tell you that I think most of it isn't related to the bill that's in front of you, which I think is, it may be the largest size-wise of any bill this session. It's a whopping two-volume bill, and it comes to you with the recommendation of the Oregon Law Commission. I had the pleasure as a law commissioner of chairing the judgment work group during the legislative interim. This is a group that essentially for two interims has met. It's composed of over 20 individuals, and the group met 14 times as a group and then numerous times in various subcomponents of the group, working out the details of this very large bill, which exceeds 350 pages. What the bill does is essentially attempts to address in a holistic fashion the issue of how judgments are treated in the Oregon Revised Statutes. And as Mr. Hendricks could tell you, some of the language that had existed up until this bill was drafted dates back to the time that Oregon was formed as a state. Much of the language is archaic and was confusing and had been obviously modified by numerous legislative sessions over time, which didn't necessarily always add to its comprehensive value. So what this bill does in brief highlight, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is it deletes obsolete terminology. It provides a system of statutory organization by combining various ORS chapters. It provides clarity on what constitutes an appealable judgment. It clears up inaccurate statutory language on what are and what is the expiration of judgments. It fixes and addresses obsolete language with respect to writ of execution procedures. And it uses some new terms to fix problem areas, to provide consistency and to provide clarity in the statutes with respect to judgments. The terms that it uses that have been highly negotiated and worked out with this large work group, and then even in the session with some additional adjustments that were made in the House Judiciary Committee to accommodate all of the interested parties. It uses a term general judgment, a term limited judgment, and then a term supplemental judgment to provide some clarity to judges, to parties, to the Court of Appeals, and to others in understanding what it means to have a judgment entered. In conclusion, it is a very technical bill and is for that reason necessarily large because it affects so many areas of the law. One of the things we did was, for example, eliminate the misuse or the use, but not terribly accurate use, of the word decree, which was oftentimes substituted for the word judgment in many places. So much of the statutes that you see that are being amended are simply substituting out the word decree and inserting the word judgment so as there not to be confusion between those two items when in practice there really isn't any distinction in most cases. It is an area that the law over time has become in serious need of repair. It is precisely the kind of project that is the work that is best done by the Oregon Law Commission in a deliberative period of time. It's the kind of work that no one group would come forward to with this kind of set of revisions, because it just doesn't capture the interest of particular groups that might have professional lobbyists, but is exactly the kind of law improvement work that the commission was designed to address. There are, I think, a couple of amendments in front of you. The Dash 6 amendments are a combination of conflict amendments and also amendments that are coming from the commission's work group. It includes a technical amendment which allows a $4 fee that allows creditors to recoup a portion of the up to $4 of their cost for issuing a garnishment. This was something the work group considered and agreed to by way of amendment. You also have a Dash A7 amendment in front of you, which is to address the case of Shoup versus Walmart, which is an appellate decision. This amendment was not considered by the Judgment and Garnishment Work Group or the Oregon Law Commission, and so comes to you as a standalone amendment, and I'll let the parties who want to speak to that amendment speak to the committee about it. This judgments bill, obviously, given the nature of the bill, has a fairly large relating clause, and I think was viewed as an appropriate vehicle if the committee were inclined to adopt the amendment. You have another bill later on your agenda, which I won't be speaking to, Mr. Chairman, because I'll need to be gone, but is another law commission bill, and I think there's another case in that bill where, given the nature of the bill, it would accommodate an amendment that was not approved or recommended by the law commission, but we recognize that that's sometimes how this process works. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be pleased to answer any questions that you have. Mr. Hendricks, I want to comment on particularly, he was the glue that kept this process together. He sat with the work group over all of its meetings and spent countless hours preparing the drafts, resolving the issues, and is certainly the person and authoring the report, which you should have in your file from the Law Commission on the impact of the bill, and really deserves much of the credit in taking what has been a broken down part of the Oregon Revised Statutes and making them ultimately better, more readable, and more understanding in the overhaul kind of work that this body should do and should consider valuable. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Appreciate it. We actually do appreciate Mr. Hendricks in many ways. He staffed most of the PERS bills going through this process, and quite honestly, they all get very confusing to me because you have bright people on both sides of any of the various arguments. Wendy, did you want to say something in addition to what Representative Williams has shared? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would reiterate that the Commission would support the Dash 6s and the Dash 7s. The Commission has no position on. The work group has not reviewed those amendments.
On the Dash 7s.
I do have additional testimony that I'd like to submit. It should be coming momentarily, that just supplements the report on some issues that were changed on the House side when that report was actually written.
All right.
About 2.5 pages. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Any testimony?
I think Representative Williams has done a fine job of giving you the overview. You have the report, which I think is the nice thing about OLC bills, is that you have it all in writing before you. I wanted to say that after having Representative Williams say all those nice things about me, I did want to say that Representative Williams should be recognized for putting in an incredible amount of work on this project as well, a project that doesn't have a lot of sex appeal, but is one of those things that needs to be done every now and then, a comprehensive big bill that needs to go through and spend the time, and did a wonderful job on keeping everybody on board and in good spirits through a long process, and that's all I'll say.
Was there a specific model that you were using or were you following in other states?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there really wasn't, and the reason that there wasn't a specific model was because the statutes, as they had developed over time, were very individual. The processes, the approaches to writs of execution. Mr. Hendricks could probably talk to comparisons that we did in some other places, but because much of what we were building on, even when trying to unify the issue around judgments, is particular to the way Oregon's process works, Our rules of civil procedure, our rules of evidence, the rules of appellate court process, it really did require sort of an individual molding of a bill to address particularly how this process has developed over time in Oregon and to deal with some of the anomalies that had particularly developed in the way our statutes were being treated. I think that's a fairly accurate description.
Representative Williams, Chair Minnis, that's correct. We actually had a law student from Willamette when we first got into the project with the judgments go out to look and see if any other state had tried to do a comprehensive revision, and we couldn't find one that had done so. And I think part of the reason is it is sort of state-specific about how their law has evolved on the topic. And one of the driving things with this project was that our laws, starting with the adoptions of the rules of civil procedure back in the late 70s or early 80s, had been trying to get away from this distinction between law and equity. And the trouble was that even with doing that, you can make the statement, we're going to abolish the distinctions, but things like judgments and decrees, which were, you know, part of the things that were left from that distinction still linger out there, and this is part of a larger, I view this as kind of a larger, part of a larger long-term process to start getting rid of that distinction, one that doesn't make much sense under the law anymore. It's still there in the statutes, and it's just part of the process of cleaning it out.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Walker?
Thank you, honorable and esteemed chairman.
It sounds like her.
Yes.
Starting to nod off.
This is Peter Courtney Day, by the way.
Learning in high council.
I apologize for not having dressed appropriately.
I didn't get the message either. So.
Learned in high council, Representative Williams. I actually have a question for you. A couple of them came up. One is I want to thank you also because I was on the Judiciary Committee in 99 and we talked about this and you went boldly and went forth where no man had ever gone before. So I appreciate your work on that. But a couple questions came up. One, you talked about a $4 fee to assess administer a garnishment or collect on a garnishment. We had a bill earlier this session brought by the Restaurant Association that allowed a $1 collection fee. So can you tell me somebody, Dave is nodding his head and shaking his head, so tell me how those two relate.
Chairman, Senator Walker, the bill you were referring to that you had before your committee earlier this session would have allowed a garnishee, that is the employer or bank who receives a garnishment on a judgment, to collect a fee, processing fee, for basically handling the paperwork on the garnishment. The proposed amendment that you have in this bill, it relates to a different situation. It's a situation where the person who has the judgment creditor, has gone out and issued a garnishment and expended money to try to collect on a judgment. The amendment would allow the judgment creditor to add $4, up to $4 for that, to the judgment amount and treat it as being as part of the judgment. So it's a quite a bit different situation that we're talking about.
Okay. I didn't want to read through all of this to find that $4 issue, so I thought it'd be easier to ask.
There's a list of things now in the existing law that you can add to a judgment of that type, and so this ended of about 10 things, and this was not on the list, so this added for additional amount that can be collected as part of the judgment that costs that are incurred after the judgment's entered.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then, Ms. Johnson, my question to you is I didn't understand my notes. I wrote in my notes that you support the Dash 6 and Dash 7, but I'm not sure I heard you correctly. So could you please explain that?
Thank you, Chairman. Senator Walker. The Dash 6 is the Oregon Law Commission does support. The Dash 7, we have no position on.
No position. Okay, I was hoping you would say that because I didn't... think that you were supporting those or had taken a position. Okay. Well, that that concludes my comments, and I look forward to joining you on the Law Commission in September.
Thank you.
And I'm glad you've already done this.
There's more work to do, Senator, I can assure you.
The good thing about the senator here is she takes very, very good notes. In fact, be careful, she'll poach you verbatim.
Mr. Chair, having had Senator Wagner, when she was but a mere representative, serve on the House Judiciary Committee, I'm well acquainted with her ability at
her
shorthand skill.
All right, great. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm wondering, what's the genesis of the Dash 6 amendments, such that they weren't included in the original? With later negotiations, later input, what brought these suggestions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, we adopted some additional amendments in the House version of the bill. I think what occurred was a recognition among some of the interest groups, particularly those who spend a considerable amount of time on garnishment type issues, that this was an area that hadn't been addressed, and it was proposed to the work group, which is and I should take just a moment to explain that the work group was a broad cross-section of folks who care about issues involving judgments and garnishments, and that's everybody from banks to title companies, to various government offices, the support enforcement people, also included public law folks who spent a considerable amount of time representing low-income Oregonians, and that group was essentially a well-represented group of people. And I think when this issue was brought forward in the work group, there was an acknowledgement that the collection of a limited amount of that $4 fee was an appropriate thing to allow as an add-on once that was going forward. Dave?
I would add to that, Chairman, as Senator Ringo, that, you know, that's a big set of amendments. Now, there's three things going on in there. There's conflict amendments that are really, truly technical.
Right.
There were a number of other things. This was such a large bill that when it came out at the end, people did not have a chance to look at it just from a purely technical point of view. There are a lot in the A6s, in addition to the one change relating to garnishment, the garnishment fee, there are a whole lot of changes that were suggested by the Department of the courts, and also by the Department of Justice, who did a very extensive section by section review after it was printed, and a lot of these were things that just were caught afterwards.
I recall last session we did a comprehensive rewrite of the garnishment statute, so I'm kind of wondering what prompts the additional rewrite of this.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, we also did a smaller adjustment to the garnishment statute this session. It just moved much quicker out of committee before these issues were sufficiently vetted and got over here, and I think this was viewed as an appropriate thing. And because the group had been the judgment and garnishments work group, it was the same set of people who were involved in this one, and that's why I think the assent was given.
I just want to follow up a little bit more on the $4 fee. I am troubled by that, just because I think it is a new fee, and I think it's hitting people that already are generally unable to pay. That's why they're in such a punishment. But I'm curious as to what discussions and negotiations took place around that, and why $4.
Excuse me, Chairman and Senator Ringo, I can speak to that. This amendment was actually proposed by Jim Marquis, and the reason for it was the statute already allows a $4 fee if the courts issue that garnishment. Problem is, with budget cuts right now, courts are no longer issuing that $4 fee. So if you choose to go to the attorney to get the garnishment issued, you won't get the $4 added on. So some garnishers out there are losing that $4 times, you know, 100 or so different garnishments, and they're losing that money. They didn't allow you to recoup the whole amount that you'd have to be charged by the attorney, so they capped it at $4, which is the court fee. So that the work group looked at that and said, you know, that is being added on as policy anyway. The legislature put that $4 fee in statute. So to transfer it to attorneys in the same situation isn't really a change.
Well, in the current situation, the $4 fee would be received by the court. So the court issues the garnishment.
Right, the court's charging $4, so then the creditor gets, or the garnisher gets to recoup that $4 back that they paid out. So this amendment would just say, okay, if garnisher, if you're going to be charged $4 or more than $4 by an attorney to issue that same garnishment, we're going to let you recoup that cost that you paid out, up to $4.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, if you go down and have the court issue your garnishment, you pay the court the $4, but you're allowed to tack that $4 onto the amount that you collect from the debtor. And so the policy extension here is just to say, instead of having the court issue the garnishment, if you go and have an attorney issue garnishment, you're allowed to recoup that same $4 amount, even though that $4 amount will not compensate you for what the attorney will charge. It capped it at that same level so there wasn't any distinction. But in part, the issue I think that the members of the work group felt was appropriate is, given the limited court resources and the budget situation and the potential, at least, of in reality some cases where garnishments weren't being addressed by the court as a result of budget cuts, that you didn't want garnishments essentially stacking up at the court when there was another alternative, and if this would cause people to use their attorney-issued writs as opposed to court-issued writs to recover that $4, it was both beneficial to the court and wasn't truly an extension of policy when that fee could already get collected if they were court-issued garnishments. So ultimately, it seemed like a court savings approach. It seemed fair, and capping it at the same rate as the court didn't seem to create any additional burden, frankly, on the debtor.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I understand it's nice to have that symmetry, but I don't think it's in our interest to allow additional charges on the debtors. I don't think that's in our interest, and I have a hard time thinking that people's behavior is changed by that $4 fee. I don't think too many creditors with attorneys would say, "Gee, I can put off a $4 fee if I go through the court." I think most attorneys just would probably prepare their own writs of garnishment and get it out the door, and it's not worth it to go to the court to try to capture that $4.
Mr. Chairman, Minister, Senator Ringo, I guess what I would say to that is, I think in small matters where a person does, you know, a handful of garnishments a year as part of their practice, you're probably right. In large volume debtor operations like that, I think I would beg to differ with you. I think, in fact, that $4 fee and your ability to recoup that in the garnishment does provide a significant incentive. And those volume ones are the ones that, obviously, if they're ending up in the court, it's going to create additional burden and time as opposed to having private attorneys issue them and recover. But, I do think ultimately it makes a difference.
All right. Any additional comments? I'm going to bring up the proponents of the Dash 7 amendments and have them speak to that. So, you're finished.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could be excused, I've got other business of the House to attend.
Yes, sir. If this thing spirals out of control, we'll call you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. We have Betsy Earls and Richard Lane. I'm not sure. Oh, you guys are on opposite sides of this thing. So, okay. Betsy Earls first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing the law firm of Harang Long Gary Rudnick. And I'm before you today on behalf of Phil Gary, the president of our firm, who, like all of us, would like to talk with you about the Dash 7 amendments and urge your support of those to House Bill 2646. Dash 7 amendments provide that a change in appellate procedure that was recently announced by the Oregon Supreme Court, actually at the end of January, Shoup versus Walmart Stores, will not apply to cases that were tried before that change was announced. Application of the new rule to cases that were tried before the Shoup decision came down would be unfair because litigants base trial strategy and their tactical procedural choices on rules as they existed before Shoup. The outcome of appeals will be directly affected by those tactical choices, and therefore we would ask that you adopt the Dash 7 amendments limiting the Shoup decision only to prospective cases. Shoup dealt with the subject of harmless error, which is somewhat arcane, but for our purposes today, it's probably worth understanding. And I'll just talk with you briefly about what that rule is, how it worked before Shoup, and how it works now. We're not taking a position on whether the rule announced in Shoup is better or worse public policy than what we had before. All we're here to talk with you about today is limiting that decision to judgments that happened after Shoup was announced. Our position is that the rule should not be changed after a case has been tried based upon a different rule, and our Dash 7 amendments will address the unfairness of applying Shoup retroactively, which is the way it's applied right now. Before Shoup, when an appellate court could clearly see that an error in trial had affected the outcome of a case, the judgment would be reversed and the case would be remanded for a new trial. On the other hand, if the reviewing court could tell that an error had made, there had been error, but it hadn't made a difference to the trial outcome, in other words, it was a harmless error, the judgment would generally be affirmed. I think the question comes in if the effect of an error is unclear in the case where there's more than one specification. Sometimes it's completely impossible to tell whether the error affected the outcome in a situation like that. For example, or to explain, a plaintiff could allege that a defendant was negligent in two different respects, and one of those respects could be valid and the other one would be legally defective. In other words, it would be based on an error. If the jury were to return a generalized verdict or general verdict of negligence, it would be impossible, basically, for a reviewing court to determine whether that verdict was based on the valid specification or the defective or erroneous specification. So in the past, in that situation, as I mentioned, Oregon courts have resolved those uncertainties in favor of ensuring that parties receive a fair trial. And under what the Oregon Supreme Court has dubbed the "we can't tell" rule, appellate courts have always reversed those questionable judgments and sent them back for a new trial. But in January, the Oregon Supreme Court overruled its own precedent and abandoned the "we can't tell" rule in Shoup versus Walmart stores. And in Shoup, the court held that uncertainty as to whether an error affected the outcome of the trial must be resolved by actually affirming the judgment, which is the exact opposite of what they had done before, which was to send it back for a new trial. Even when the reviewing court, which is the appellate court, is able to conclude that the trial court committed some kind of error that likely affected the outcome or led to a faulty outcome, the judgment now must be affirmed on appeal unless the appellant can actually prove or point to something in the record that the outcome was affected by the error. So I think the problem comes in that rather than announcing that new rule prospectively when Shoup was handed down, the court applied it right then to Shoup as well as to everything in the future, I think. And now Oregon appellate courts are likely to apply that new approach in every case they see, regardless of whether it was tried and a judgment was handed in before Shoup was announced. In other words, they're changing the rules after the trial has already been played. So under the "we can't tell" rule, a defendant who's charged with two kinds of negligence had an advantage if the case was submitted to the jury and came down with a general verdict. If one of the two charges was defective, a judgment would be reversed on appeal. On the other hand, under the Shoup rule, a defendant needs to request a special verdict, which is one in which the jury identifies which charge of negligence was actually defective and which one they relied on. So prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Shoup, it was widely recognized, I think, and depended on tactically by most attorneys that defendants were well advised to seek a general verdict. Litigants relied on this rule when they developed trial strategy, and in Shoup, the Oregon Supreme Court turned that rule on its head. So future litigants, everybody who comes after Shoup, obviously can alter their trial strategy to take that rule into account, but litigants in cases that had already been tried don't have the opportunity to do that. So we're not asking you to overrule Shoup, change Shoup, talk about whether Shoup is good or bad policy. We would just like you to apply it prospectively only so that people who have already tried cases based on the old rule can continue under that rule. And that's my testimony, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any questions?
No questions. Well, I see a cat. I see one brewing here. But she's brewing while she's chewing.
Yeah.
I
can wait. Excuse me. Now, our chairman would never do such a thing. You know, some of us just don't have enough breakfast in the morning because nobody cares about us or thinks about us in any way. But, you know, we just go to work and we try to do our best. And we just, you know, it's hell. Anyway.
Me too.
Mr. Chairman,
nobody likes me, everybody hates me.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think it's obligatory for the rest of the committee members to talk and busy themselves in other ways as well. These impressions are kind of to add up anticipation.
Yeah, no kidding. Do you have a real question? Or
yes, I actually do. This is kind of a complicated area. What you're referring to cases that are through the trial court and are now on appeal?
Right, that's correct.
And so what would happen, you say that the court applied it retroactively.
Well, they applied, Mr. Chair and Senator Byrd, they applied it right then to the case that was before them. Instead
so,
of
so what you're saying is that these cases that have been through the trial court, they would have to be retried if we didn't have this amendment, or are you just saying they would be doomed automatically in the court, and that's not fair? I just don't understand.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, what I'm saying is that when the cases that we're talking about were in trial, they had one set of rules, and under those rules, if they had two different specifications of negligence, and maybe one was defective or based on error and one wasn't, and then the jury returned a general verdict, you couldn't tell whether they depended on error or not. And so in order to make sure there was a fair trial, the appellate court would generally remand it for a new trial. But if you asked for a special verdict, you know, beforehand, before it went to the jury, you'd be able to tell which one the jury depended on. So if the jury didn't depend on error to decide the case, it would be affirmed. But with a special verdict, if they did depend on error, it would be clear that the case would be sent back. Most of the time, defendants asked for a general verdict because if it was unclear, you know, it was more advantageous to them to send it back. Under Shoup, that slipped around so that if it's not clear if the jury depended on error, the case is affirmed instead of sent back. So I think the question is really whether attorneys asked for a general verdict in the past, whether a general verdict or a special verdict. They made decisions on stuff like that based on what was tactically advantageous to them under the old rules. And then here comes the Supreme Court, which I guess it's their prerogative to do, and said, actually, those are the wrong rules. We're going to do something new here. And
I guess my question is if it went to the Supreme Court, then does it have a constitutional basis? The Shoup decision, did it have a constitutional basis? Because I have real questions about changing a statute to try to statutorily override a constitutional ruling.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, again, we're not trying to override the entire ruling just for a certain set of cases that were through trial when the ruling came down. The rule is probably close to 100 years old. I think if you flip through your stuff, I didn't want to read all of my or Mr. Gary's testimony to you, but there's a page on legal context that does go through some of the constitutional bases for the rule as it was in the past. American appellate courts used to express the focus of their review in terms of whether error at trial affected the substantial rights of the parties. And I think that phrase was generally understood to refer to any error that affected the fairness of the trial by calling into question the reliability of the outcome. And you can see then we go through, by the mid-1860s, the Oregon legislature had enacted a harmless error statute. Then we go down to where it's codified right now, ORS 19.415.
I guess I understand that, but without regard to the merits, the bottom line is that the Supreme Court has made a constitutional ruling that as long as these rules existed, that they're not constitutional. So to try to attempt to override a constitutional ruling by statutory means I just don't think it would work, even if it had merit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I could be mistaken, but it's not my understanding that this was a decision that declared those rules unconstitutional. There were statutory rules codified in ORS 19415.
So this was a ruling that was based on interpretation of statute?
No? That's my understanding. Yes. So I don't think we have a case of unconstitutional rules.
Okay. Help me understand, too, Betsy, is the danger, I mean, the reason you might want to not apply SHUT retroactively is that it might revive cases that were assumed to be resolved? Or, because it seems to me that SHUT would apply for any case that's currently on appeal.
I think that's true, Mr. Chair. I think that I'm not sure if it would actually revive cases that were already tried and done with. I think it would actually...
Assuming that the statute of limitations hasn't told timelines. I don't know.
I think it just changes, Mr. Chair, the advantage and the disadvantages of having made certain decisions and puts you in a completely different position.
I guess I'm just trying to figure out who it affects retroactively. Who's affected by the retroactivity issue that you want to change?
Specifically?
Well, I mean, yeah, how many cases? Do we have cases out there? I mean, are there?
There's a few. We have about three on appeal ourselves.
Okay, so you have cases, or your firm has cases on appeal now.
That's correct.
That were tried in the trial court under the previous rules.
That's
correct. And so you want to apply the previous rules in... That's an interesting...
On appeal just for those,
thought.
Not for everything.
All right. Well,
other
thank
people
you.
Have different positions.
I want to get Mr. Lane up here to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to oppose the Dash 7's amendments to 2646. I would say, as far as the body of the 2646 bill, that's a heck of a lot of work that a lot of people put in, and people in my organization got bleary-eyed going through the 400-odd pages, and it is a quality piece of legislation that has been presented to you. So the body, I would highly recommend. The Dash 7, we would oppose any of the revitalization of the Winston We Can't Tell rule. Basically, what the proponents are asking for is a retroactive application of a change by a Supreme Court. They want to capture a certain amount of cases that, because of a rule change by the Supreme Court or a decision, a certain number of individuals have been now prejudiced or claim they've been prejudiced, left out of court, or suffered some sort of injury as a result of a change in the Supreme Court. So they want to capture a small amount of cases retroactively. And we would be opposed to such a retroactive application of a change in legislation. The chair inquired about cases that were actually affected or attempted to be affected by this. Ms. Earls identified at least three cases. I'm aware of one. It's a case involving Philip Morris that the Harang Law Firm is actually involved in. And in that footnote, footnote inside that brief, they note that this problem was identified in Winston and could have been cured by a request for a special verdict. So there's no change in the rules. The Supreme Court finally got around to using a straight statutory construction of ORS 19. Let me take the committee back just a moment for Winston. I like examples. Straight two-car collision. The defendant inside the case is alleged to have been drunk, ran a red light, and was speeding. Case goes to trial. Evidence comes in on those three allegations. Case goes up on appeal because the defendant loses. On review, the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals finds that there's clear evidence to support that he was drunk driving, and that caused the injury. There's clear evidence that he was speeding, and that caused the injury. But whether the red light was actually involved, we don't think there's evidence to support that allegation. So two clear bases for upholding the judgment. one suspect, according to the reviewing court. Winston said that we can't tell whether the jury rendered its verdict based upon the speed. We agree that the defendant is liable because he was drunk and because he was speeding, but because we can't tell, we're going to send it back for a new trial. Along comes Shoup. Shoup looks at ORS 19. It says that the scope of review on a case is we will reverse if the person seeking a reversal or a modification of the judgment can show that he has been or she has been substantially prejudiced as a result of an error inside the case. The court recognizes our policy in this state is to have finality, and the rule should be that cases are retried in extraordinary circumstances, not in the usual course. And they said Winston was wrongly decided. Didn't change anything. If any defendant claims that a ruling by the trial court substantially impaired or prejudiced their rights, they get a new trial. And that has always been the case according to the statutory construction, and Shoup was the case that actually analyzed the ORS 19 statutory appeal. So there's no big change in the law. Winston, in fact, noted that to protect, I think he used the word, a careful practitioner is always going to request a special verdict. So you know exactly what the jury's up to. But as you just heard, some of the defendants would prefer a general verdict in order to sort of take advantage of the we can't tell. And the Supreme Court said, we're not going to have any of this we can't tell. If you claim an error, show us the error. If the error substantially impacted your rights, we'll reverse and give you a new trial.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Under your interpretation, if in your automobile example, if that case got to the Supreme Court now after Shoup, would there be any remedy for the defendant now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, if Shoup was applied to my hypothetical case and the reviewing court applied Shoup to those facts, the defendant would have the right to say that whatever evidence was admitted regarding the light substantially impacted my rights to a fair trial. And if the court agreed, then they would get a new trial. But they would have a burden to show that, just like any moving party has a burden to show that an error was committed and it substantially impacted my rights to a fair trial. That would be the rule that the court said is going to apply to every case that comes to us on review.
And Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Whereas if the trial attorney had requested,
special
verdict, and the special verdict had said we're relying on the red light, then clearly the court would refer it for retrial.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, if the defendant in the hypothetical had requested a special verdict and the jury returned a verdict that said no as to drunk driving, no as to speeding, yes as to light, and that got to review and the court found no evidence of light, then yes, you would have a substantial prejudice to your rights and be entitled to a new trial.
Okay.
But if they found yes as to drunk driving, yes as to speeding, yes as to light, then the burden would be on the defendant to show that the light somehow was a substantial the evidence of a running of a red light, whatever it was the thing that substantially impaired your rights as opposed to the very valid finding on the drunk driving or the speeding.
So with either a directed verdict or a special verdict or a general verdict, they'd have to, unless they said no on the two things they had the good evidence, they would have to prove prejudice.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that would be correct. If there was a no to the other ones that were supported by the evidence and a yes to the one that wasn't, the court would apply the presumptive then impairment of your existing rights or a prejudice to your rights because there was no evidence.
So, Mr. Chairman, if they had one yes, if they had the one with the good evidence and they had a special verdict on that and then they also had a special verdict on the one with the bad evidence, the good evidence would trump the bad one unless they could make a showing. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that is correct.
All right. Thank you. Any other testimony on
2646. Any questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Lane. We're going to close the public hearing on this. We'll bring it back on Monday or Tuesday. Give people a chance to read them. Decide what they want to decide.
Mr. Chairman, I did hand out a copy of that case to everybody, and
I appreciate that you did that, counsel, because I was fascinated about what the underlying issue was. So I will read that.
The next Sterling issue before the committee is 2594, work session, and Representative Prozanski is here with some amendments. And Carl Myers was here earlier, but he had to be in court, and he told me that he had seen your amendment and has no problems with it.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
No problems.
No problems with it.
Yeah, thank you very much for stating that on the record. I did speak with Mr. Myers. He did tell me that I could, on his behalf, that he was fine with the amendment. The amendment to 2594, which is the dash one, would allow for municipal courts who choose to, in other words, this would be a permissive, to allow them to become courts of record. And the reasons this is coming forward through this process is we actually had another bill that was on the House side that got bogged down because of some technical difficulties that were involved in some potential amendments with that bill. Because of that, I spoke with the Speaker's office as well as with the chair of the committee, and we agreed that it would probably be best to see if we could find another vehicle to use to put 3067 into. And this is House Bill 2594 as a relating clause that will allow that to occur. Again, the dash one will allow municipal courts who want to become courts of record to do so. There are certain requirements for a municipal court to become a court of record, including that the individual sitting in court as the judge would have to be an active member of the bar, in other words, licensed and trained as a as an attorney, and they also would have to meet the requirements of setting courts of record, either having someone that would be, as the Senator Walker would know, a court reporter, or they'd have to have the mechanisms for electronic recording of those of that testimony and the trial in itself. The reason the amendment is necessary is because some of the municipal courts are wanting to allow them, or I should say some of the municipalities want to consider courts of record, so it will cut down the cost of providing the safeguards that are required under our current rules. Courts of record are ones that when there's an appeal, it goes directly to the court of appeal, and it's a record has been established. The parties of that case are able to rely on that record and make their appeal accordingly. Where you're going to see most of the cases that will be coming forward would be in the criminal area, the area that I practice in, and I'll give you the scenario of what would happen, or what currently happens in the city of Florence, where it is not a court of record. Because it is not a court of record, a defendant has the right to have a court of record decide whether or not the person is guilty. So we basically have two jury trials. The first one is in a municipal court, not a court of record. The person is found guilty of DUII, driving under the influence of intoxicants. They, meaning the defendant, wants to challenge that. So they do what is known as a de novo hearing or trial. And that is basically you file an appeal to the circuit court, which is a court of record. They then have the second opportunity to have a jury trial as if the first never occurred. And so the prosecutor and the city has the duty of proving a person's guilt twice to two separate juries before you have a valid conviction that stands where at that point. If there's any other appeals to be taken, it would go to the court of appeals. This bill will allow for those cities who choose to become courts of record the ability to cut the cost of providing the obligations they have in proving someone's guilt. If they have a court of record at the municipal level, an appeal would go directly from that court to the court of appeals. It would bypass the state courts, which would save money and time for the state court system, because they would not have to have a second jury trial. And also the cities would also benefit because their prosecution services as well as their witnesses, normally are going to be officers, would not be getting paid twice to do the same or carry out the same trial, which has already been proven beyond a reasonable doubt at the municipal court level. That's the basis and the substance of the dash ones. And I also would like to advise the committee that I did have an opportunity to speak with one of the representatives of the League of Cities, and they also are they are neutral on the bill because they had not had an opportunity to take a position on it. But they do believe that anything that will allow more latitude for cities to have discretion in how they operate and their cities, they do support. And so I would say that you have a lukewarm support, no opposition to the bill from the League of Cities.
All right. We're in work session.
Chairman.
Senator Birdie.
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2594.
Senator Birdie moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 2594. Discussion.
Only, Mr. Chair, that I'm disappointed that we have to add for audio recording reporting device, because I think court reporters should be in the courtroom. But that's just my comment. There are a lot of problems with audio recordings, and attorneys can testify to that, as well as court reporters who've been asked to try to make sense out of them.
Okay.
Beyond that, it's an okay bill.
All right. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. For passing. Senator Brick.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2594 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brick moves House Bill 2594 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Objection. Motion passes. And any volunteers to carry the bill?
Okay.
Senator Ringo will carry the bill then. Great. We've got 2278. Let's do it. Let's start with 2308. Right. Let's start with 2278. And Council, would you give us a little background on the main bill, and then we have some amendments that Senator Ringo is bringing. We'll discuss those. I think that's where most of our testimony is lined up.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 2278, again, if you recall, deals with terminology for public bodies. It's a bill that clears up definitions for various public bodies. There are two amendments before you. The dash five amendments, I believe, are from Senator Ringo, and I'll let him address those. The dash six amendments deal with a technical issue of the captioning in the bill and what effect the captioning has. Essentially, captions are usually for the assistance of the reader. Do you want to talk about the dash five, Senator Ringo?
Sure, I'm glad to. I have some, I guess, packets of information.
Oh, this is your taxicab bill. Sorry.
I've spoken to most of you about this already, and I introduced this bill on the House side, and it was in Jerry Crummell's committee, and then he came over to me and he wanted his land use bill moved, and I couldn't do that, so that's why this is presented in terms of adding it on to an Oregon Law Commission bill that has a right to landing clause. And I guess I just give away a little bit of background. There's a taxi driver who was a constituent. He's not anymore, but he was at the time, named Alexei Cassian, who approached me and explained to me the situation that a taxi company could go from the Hillsboro or Beaufort area down to the Portland airport, but not take a return fare. And that just seemed unfair, and so that's when I've been looking into this. And I've had a long series of communications with the Portland folks, the Metro folks, about this issue, and that's what this packet is. And if you look at the very front page of the packet, there's a letter from Metro, or from a Dave Bragan, a shareholder of Metro, to Jim Francesconi. And at that time, Jim Francesconi was the Portland City Commission on Taxis. And they're enclosing this white paper that analyzes the taxi issue. And you'll see it's at the top says proposal, regionalization of taxi licensing. And this is something that was put together by Metro. And if you look, I've highlighted it, it points out some of the anomalies in the current system. A passenger can pick up at a grocery store on 181st Avenue in Gresham, but cannot be carried to his apartment on 148th in Portland. If that particular cab did not have a license plate, did not have a license for Portland. And it just seems intrinsically unfair and inefficient. And then if you look at the big quote at the bottom of this page, and this is a quote from a fellow named Jim Wadsworth, who was Portland's licensing director, where he talks about you can go from Beaverton or Gresham or Hillsborough to downtown Portland, but you can't take a return fare. And this is the city of Portland guy speaking when he says a regional authority is the only answer. So this was in the white paper that was put together by Metro to address this issue. The next thing in this packet is really part of that. It's an Oregonian article on the same issue, which talks about the community has changed. The Portland metro area has changed. This was in 2001, and I've had ongoing series of conversations. The next letter from the city of Beaverton, Mayor Rob Drake, who said, yes, we had similar problems in Beaverton, where the anomalies in the taxi going to one area but not the other area just doesn't seem fair. Then the next thing I'd like to show you, there's a letter dated November 27th, 2001, that was written, it was signed by five Washington County legislators to Metro, essentially urging Metro to assume responsibility for the taxi permitting. I was the one who coordinated this letter, and I sent a copy of this letter to Jim Francisconi at Metro, and that's what the next letter is, the transmittal letter. And all during this time, nobody from Portland ever contacted me and thought this was a bad idea. They told me it was a bad idea. In fact, everybody always agreed it made sense. When I'm talking to folks at Metro, when I'm talking to folks in Portland, Beaverton, Hillsborough, everybody that I spoke with on this issue kind of agreed that, yes, it made sense for Metro to handle taxi permitting. And they were holding hearings on this, but as governments tend to do, they get bogged down and they never seem to move forward. The next thing I have is this January 25th letter, 2002, and this is a response from David Bragdon. He says, essentially agrees, archaic political boundaries are preventing efficiency, entrepreneurship, and customer service. And I think that is the generally accepted view. Again, near the back of this packet, there's a letter I sent on January 30th, 2003, to the five Portland City Councilors, letting them know of my intention to introduce legislation on this that would make Metro responsible for permitting. I did not receive one phone call from anybody on behalf of the city saying that they thought it was a bad idea. Not one city councilor called me up and said, gee, Charlie, we really appreciate that you want to do that. So I was letting them know exactly what was going on. And I assumed their tacit support. And I really believe I still have the tacit support from almost every Portland City Councilor. The only communication I received directly in response to this was a letter, which is the last thing in the pack, from Dan Saltzman, who pretty much thanked me for pushing this. And he pointed out some additional issues that needed to be addressed, such as town cars. But he agreed that the current system was inefficient and unfair and needed to be changed. That was the only communication I received from any Portland folks in response to my letter. You know, it's a fair question. Well, why is it necessary for the state legislature to get involved in this? Why can't more Portland and all the local governments just handle it by themselves? And I think that the best answer is because of the political turf protecting by the Portland taxi establishment that is genuinely afraid of competition. They are genuinely afraid of people outside of the Portland area competing with them. And so they're able to exert political pressure in certain areas that's made it difficult for them to move forward. I'd like to relate a conversation I had with Jim Francisconi, who was the Portland City Councilor who had the authority for the taxis. And this conversation occurred earlier this year, and he said, Charlie, I want to make 3 points to you. He said, number one, you're absolutely right. Metro should handle taxi permits. to point number two, it's a really complicated thing. You need to give it 2 years. You've got issues of big companies versus little companies, insurance, safety, dispatching. There's lots of sticky issues. You have to give it 2 years. And then point number three was that this issue was originally brought to me by my constituent. It may never help him. He may never have the ability to go to Portland Airport and take a fare just because he doesn't have the right capacity. So it may never help him. But those are the three points of Francis Scone, who I think has the most experience and expertise in this issue. And again, his point number one was, yes, Metro should do it. Now, when I introduced the bill on the House side, I received some technical objections, and I've done everything I can to address them. One of the objections was, when you know, it's fine to talk about taxis, but there's other forms of transportation, like town cars, jitneys, van pools, and you need to make sure that the bill covers everything. So it is amended to cover everything. Next, there was a question from the Port of Portland about, you know, this airport, that falls under the Port of Portland, under the port's jurisdiction, there are certain safety issues. Okay, we don't want to interfere with their ability to regulate safety in the airport. So there's a specific exception that says this does not take away the port's ability to regulate with regard to safety issues. And as far as the implementation date, December 31st, 2005. So this is 2.5 years down the road as to when this would become applicable. So I believe that this has addressed every one of the technical objections that exist. So then you have to ask, well, what are the real objections? And I have a letter here from Michael Colley, who's Mary Nolan's legislative assistant, and also on the Portland Taxi Board. He wrote me a letter with about 15 different objections. And I think none of them have a lot of merit, but you always know somebody has a weak case when their objections are shifting, and there's kind of a new objection here, or a new one rises out of there. Senator Walker related to me how Mr. Colley had said, well, gee, one of the reasons you can't do this is now the city of Portland is implementing a program where now there's going to be safety cameras in the taxis for the safety of the driver, which is obviously a good thing, and that moving it to Metro would disrupt that. And all I can say to Senator Walker is, well, that's news to me, because in the 15 or 16 items listed in Mr. Colley's letter, that's not there. It's a brand new one. And that's one of the difficulties I've had on this issue, is there always seems to be a new objection or a new argument. And when you examine them closer, they really don't seem to have a lot of merit. One of the arguments is, you know, taxes are barely making it in Portland. And that's one of I did have a conversation when I called Randy Leonard a couple weeks ago, and that's his argument. He said, gee, Charlie, you know, these taxis are barely making it in Portland. And I think that is accurate. And the reason is because they over-allocated the permits. They issued too many permits in Portland. And that's a problem that they're having to address. And I guess my response to that would be, my bill itself doesn't issue any new permits. It doesn't let the Hillsborough cabbie or the Gresham cabbie or the Tiger cabbie go to the airport. But it essentially sets up a regional mechanism to study it and to manage it, so that at least as we go into the future, these decisions can be made on a regional basis, which really is what makes sense. So when the opposition is, gee, these cabbies are barely making it right now, I am sympathetic to that. And I guess I'd point out, I do represent Northwest Portland. I have no desire to hurt Portland businesses. But in the long run, transportation issues need to be managed on a regional basis. And just about everybody acknowledges that's true for taxi permitting. When I've discussed this with Mark before, the lobbyist for Portland, she doesn't really dispute that. She doesn't really dispute the concept that Metro ought to assume responsibility. She'll just say, well, it has to be done carefully. And I would say this gives 2.5 years, so that's plenty of time for it to be implemented carefully. A lot of the discussion has been kind of attacking my motives in terms of, gee, Ringo's doing this for one constituent. I kind of resent that. Frankly, I think this is simply a step in good government. Some of the discussion has been in terms of attacking that Russian taxi driver and saying, gee, he has a bad driving record. I don't really think that's the issue. I mean, the issue is, what is a good system of government for the Portland area? And I'd just like to sum up by quoting Jim Wadsworth, Portland's licensing director. And, you know, this is in the article. This is what he said. You know, let's say a driver from Beaverton or Gresham or Hillsborough takes a passenger to Portland International Airport. Because that driver is not licensed in Portland, it is illegal to pick up a customer for the return ride. The passenger can't even call to be picked up, and the standards vary from town to town on things like safety inspections or driver background checks. A regional authority is the only answer. And that's the words from the from Jim Wadsworth, the city of Portland. So that's why I introduced the bill in the House, and that's why we're having the discussion over here on the Senate side. And I appreciate your attention.
All right. Thank you very much for the introduction. We've got a list of people who signed up, and I think we'll begin hearing from them. These are the city people. Yeah, I think based on time, the last two bills, 2094, 2368, we're not going to get to today. 2308 will set over next week. I'm sorry.
2308 is the other one.
All right, so the tobacco bills will set over until Monday. And we're going to start with Jim Wadsworth from the City of Portland. And Mr. Wadsworth, I don't know if you want to bring other persons up with you, but you're welcome to. Just introduce yourself for the record and then tell us what you want to tell us.
Chair Menis and the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. And Senator Starr, Senator Ringo, thank you for the introduction. There were a couple of things that you mentioned that weren't quite accurate. The trip from Gresham into Portland is okay. They can drop off in. They can pick somebody up in Gresham and drop off in Portland, but they can't bring them back. My quote was cut a little bit short, and indeed I did. And at that juncture, recommend that a regional solution might be the way to address some of these issues. Over the last 3 years, we've worked toward making our regulations common with the Port of Portland, which also regulates and has responsibility for the access and pickups at the airport, and with other jurisdictions, including Hillsborough, like Oswego, at one point in time Wilsonville, and Wilsonville Cab. Spoke at the Metro Policy Advisory Committee meeting in September, at which time we talked about the changes in the industry due to the economy and due to September the 11th, and what that had done to the industry. And the Metro Policy Advisory Committee recommended that Metro proceed with looking at whether regional regulation of the industry would make sense and would, in fact, be something that should be done. Senator Ringo is correct in there are, and I believe you quoted Commissioner Francesconi, and it is correct that this seemingly a very simple industry of having someone come pick you up and take you someplace has a lot more intricacies to it than would be expected. The basis for the regulation in the city of Portland and also in Hillsborough and the other jurisdictions around that do regulate is basically economic regulation. It's based on supply and demand. It's based on the number of people that there are in population, how many rides are available. We take a big chunk of the information comes from the port, where the port can provide us with the pickups and a long history of the pickups and at Portland International Airport. and we factor in the number of permits that should be out there to be able to handle the 24-hour a day, 7-day a week, 365-day a year dispatch pickup type of system that most cab companies operate. Senator Ringo mentioned the limited passenger transportation piece. There are two pieces to the transportation scheme and private for-hire transportation in Portland. The taxis are one. The limited passenger transportation industry is the other, and that is divided into three pieces. The specially attended transportation, which is for medical and for trips for the elderly, which the Multnomah County and TriMet are the largest ride providers through companies that they contract with them to provide that service, and the city licenses the vehicles and the drivers, executive sedans and shuttles. The executive sedans provide a way for someone who would want to pick up in Portland after they brought someone in to Portland and take them back to the jurisdiction from whence they came. And as a matter of fact, we have a number of companies that are executive sedan providers that are outside of the city of Portland, even in Vancouver, Washington, they pick up. We have a private for-hire transportation board of review in the city that oversees the administration and regulations that we have in effect for the for-hire transportation industries in the city. That board includes a couple of city representatives, of which I'm one, and designated as the chair of that committee. A TriMet representative, a Port of Portland representative, a representative from the Portland, Oregon Visitors Association, a member of the riding public, a member representing persons with disabilities, a private for-hire industry representative that is elected by the different industries from their standing committee, and a driver representative that is elected from members of the overall driving community. We regulate about 650 vehicles right now, currently, over 1,000 drivers and over 120 companies, and that number is growing as we continue to regulate the limited passenger transportation industry, which we are in our second year and getting ready to do our first round of relicensing. Regardless of the company and location, the majority of the business that they're doing is in Portland, where the demand is. Over the past decade, the number of companies has increased by 2,000%. They're providing for-hire transportation services. The number of drivers has increased by over 250%, and the number of vehicles has nearly tripled. We've been working, as I said, with Metro, looking at what makes sense to do, or trying to figure out whether it makes sense for Metro to do this. That has been waylaid by a couple of key factors that I don't probably need to mention, but I will: the economy and its trip south, and the September 11th of 2001, which not only impacted the port of Portland and at Portland International Airport, and you'll hear from Sam Fowler from the port, who's with me, about that, but it also has impacted our tourism. It's impacted the travel industry in general. It's impacted the hospitality industries. It's impacted the restaurants, it's impacted entertainment, any number of things. It's impacted an already oversupplied market with an under demand. The industry itself during that period of time seen significant cost increases, whether it's been in fuel or the cost of maintaining vehicles. Insurance has been an incredible increase in cost for these companies and for drivers.
Can I interject something here? I'm just kind of curious what all this has to do with the shift of regulation from Portland to Metro, because it seems that all of those things would still exist. You just have a regional government doing it as opposed to the city of Portland or other municipal governments doing it.
Mm-hmm. Chairman, the point that I'm getting to is that the industry itself right now is very unstable. And if you have a supply and demand type of industry, and that's the regulation that we've geared to, that if you open up the market at this point in time to additional providers being able to come into the city and pick up and encroach is the wrong word, but take part in that, serving that demand, which is already less than what the permitted demand is, then you impact the industry, and the industry impact generally goes directly to public safety, which is one of the key factors that we look at from a for-hire transportation board. We look for the safety of the drivers, of course, but we're also looking for the safety of the riders and general public safety. And one of the first things that happens when you have a demand that exceeds supply is you have those drivers and companies out there more hours on the street. You have them looking harder for the rides, perhaps speeding, perhaps not putting that new tire on the car that needs to be on there, perhaps not maintaining the vehicles as well as they should be maintained. The cost of that compliance and enforcement to maintain that then goes up for government. The city's program does not fully recover cost. Only 56% of the cost of the program is recovered. It is a general funded obligation for the city.
Senator Ringo.
But this bill doesn't itself put any more taxis on the road. It doesn't create any more permitted drivers in Portland.
Mm-hmm. Chair Menace and Senator Ringo, we understand that. Our questions are mainly around the limiting of local jurisdictions to be able to have regulations, and you'll hear from Mark Pettibone in just a minute about one instance of what we've been able to accomplish in Portland that isn't necessarily so in the other communities. They have not chosen to do that. They have chosen to have regulations that fit their transportation needs, which in some cases are very different from what the transportation needs are in the city of Portland. So,
Senator Ringo.
I don't really need to cut it off, but I do want to ask some questions, if that's okay. I mean, I didn't quite get the introductions. You are Mr. Wadsworth?
Yes, I'm Jim Wadsworth. I'm the director of the Bureau of Licenses, and I'm the chair of the For-Hire Transportation Board of Review.
Okay, and so this was your quote in Oregonian where you said a regional authority is the only answer.
That's not quite right. I said a regional authority may be the solution to the problem.
Okay.
May be. That was a misquote.
My discussions with most of the taxi folks, and I guess I'd like to know your opinion, is that they seem to really pretty much agree that Metro ought to take over, but they're more concerned about the details, about how you're going to get there and what the arrangements are going to be. I mean, do you have any quarrel with the concept that it does make sense for Metro to handle it? You're very careful about the details?
I believe that we need to look to see if a regional approach is right. But we already have a regional transportation authority in TriMet. And a lot of what we do in this industry is already geared to supplement TriMet and have TriMet supplement the 4-hour ground transportation. It's an alternative.
Actually, I was going to say, don't get me started on trying.
Right. But again, those pieces have to fit.
Your own quote, though, you brought about, okay, that the problems of somebody can go one way but not the other, and then you say the passenger can't even call to be picked up. I mean, you imply that's unfair, right?
It's part of our regulations, yes.
Okay, and then you say, and the standards vary from town to town on things like safety inspections. You seem to imply that that needs fixing. You've got various safety inspections in the various communities, right?
That's my understanding.
And then you have varying background checks, whether depending on what location you're in, and that it would just be better if there was some uniform standards. I mean, I that's what I'm taking from your quote from 2 years ago.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, yes, I believe that the comments that you're making have merit. The question is the timing on it and whether or not the local jurisdiction and the regional jurisdiction need the preemption to do it.
Well, all I can say is, I mean, I've been pushing this for 2 years and I haven't seen a lot of progress in the forward direction. And the bill as it's written would give you guys 2.5 years to sort out all these thorny problems. And I don't you think that's enough time?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, there may be time to start sorting out some of the problems. The timing on being able to do this may not be there, depending on the economy and depending on the industry itself and what transpires. The regional authority, as far as the Metro Policy Advisory Committee, the port that we work extensively with, and TriMet all agree that it's something that should be looked at. Is it something that we can say absolutely needs to be done? No, we cannot say that right now with confidence. Is it a possible solution? Yes, it is a possible solution.
Okay.
All right. You want to continue then with your testimony, or you want to switch over?
In the second time, let's move on to Sam Fowler, who's from the Port of Portland.
Okay. Great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think I'm listed as Don Huddleston on your sheet here, but I am in fact Sam Fowler. I'm the Senior Manager of Operations at the Port of Portland. And I'd just like to say, first of all, thank you for allowing us to take a few moments of your time. Senator Ringo, I agree with you. I think that this is a very important discussion. I think it's a discussion that needs to happen. And we're pleased to be a part of that discussion. I'd just like to talk a little bit, and I'll be very brief, about the relationship with the City of Portland, POVA, a number of other folks that we work with to look at this whole 4-hour transportation area. We think that we've done a pretty good job as far as including the key stakeholders. Over the last few years, I think we've done a pretty good job at improving the system. Is it the best? Probably not. Are there improvements that can be made? Probably yes. Within the last decade, say from 1998-97 on, we've developed at the Port of Portland a very specific improvement plan for our access system, along with POVA, along with the City of Portland, and along with the 4-hour providers. So it's all inclusive. My point is very clear. I think we have a system that works. Once again, I am certainly not saying that because the system works, it's perfect, and that we shouldn't have this discussion. I think it's a good discussion. And Senator Ringo, as you ran down the list of people that you had spoken with, unfortunately, the Port of Portland wasn't on that list. I wish we had been involved sooner, because we do just have an overlapping impact to the whole region with the folks who use their system at the airport. So I'm happy to be a part of the discussion now. More specifically about the amendments, we really appreciate your attempt to go in and answer some of those very difficult questions, especially in regards to the Port of Portland. As I read the exemption from the Port of Portland, I'm still a little concerned that we may have narrowed the requirements a little too tightly based solely on safety. There are a number of other items that we would like to look at as far as regulating the system at the airport. So that's one concern that I have. So
can you enumerate any of those other issues other than safety?
Well, to me, when I read this, the sentence here, since we've gone through so much with safety the past couple of years with orange alerts and setbacks in the garage, my first inclination is to think that we're specifically talking about those types of items. Certainly, we look at the safety of the roadway. We look at the efficiency of the roadway. We look at a balance of supply and demand. There are a number of issues that we have to look at to determine how we manage the what we call our commercial roadway.
But what would those be?
The issue with supply and demand. We have a finite system. And I'll try and tell you a little bit about how the system works. We have cabs that come and stage at our airport. That is a finite area, and we can only hold so many people in there. So we would certainly like to be able to say yes or no depending on how that area is used.
Okay, but let me ask you this question.
Yes.
Would your impression be that Metro would be insensitive to that issue?
No. We would be willing to work with the city, with Metro, with whomever.
Right.
And I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying that I would like to see a little more leeway and not just focused on the safety aspect of the exemption.
All right.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd also note I was not aware that I should have come to speak with you over the last 2 years. I wish I had been, but when I started this bill in January, nobody from your office has ever called me to come to meet with me.
Yes,
and you and a couple other folks managed we had a brief conversation in a hallway, but anytime you wanted to suggest amendments to me, you'd get free to do so.
Yeah. And as we said, Senator, the time that we met, excuse me, was one, the first time I had heard of the bill, and two, the first time you and I had met.
Okay.
And with that, I'll pass on. That's the end of my comments.
Thank you. Sam, I appreciate your testimony.
You bet.
Sir?
Pardon me, I'm a little bit nervous here. I'm Mark Pettibone, and I've been on the Taxicab Regulatory Board since its inception for approximately a decade. My main concern and interest is in providing equal and accessible transportation for the community with disabilities. And if I may say so, I think we have done an absolutely stellar job of that. We've worked very hard to develop a program by which 10% of all regulated taxi cabs in the city of Portland are required to have 10% of their vehicles ADA accessible vans, and at all times to have at least one of those vehicles on the road. This program has literally been a model for the United States. We've got the finest in the country. To the credit of the cab industry as well, on their own, they have developed an accessible cab association whereby they are actually in a very competitive market. They're actually cooperating with one another and the city so that in off-peak hours, for instance, at 4 in the morning, one cab company is always assigned to be the designated provider so that if I need a cab at 3 or 4 in the morning at the airport, one will always be there for me. This very much upsets me, frankly, that Mr. Ringo, I know of no one in the cab industry that is actually in favor of this. I also know of no one on the regulatory board that was contacted by you regarding this. This program itself for accessible vehicles potentially will just fall like a house of cards if this legislation is passed. And
we can write it in the legislation.
Well, but what do you do if Portland cabs are required to have 10% accessible vehicles? What happens if Hillsborough cab is all of a sudden allowed to provide transportation in the city of Portland, or Beaverton cab, or a cab from Jervis? Once again, the balance is off.
But if Metro regulated it, and within the universe of providers out there, there was a requirement that 10% had to be ADA approved or standardized or whatever that accessible, that would make the availability of those kind of cab services to the populations that you.
But once again, we've got a viable, functioning, successful program now, and I guess with this, there is no guarantee for continuation of services. All I'm hearing is what ifs, and that really frightens me.
Let me ask you this: are you concerned that Metro would not be sensitive to the issues of disabled persons?
Don't know. Once again, there's nothing written into this legislation that even broaches the subject. It's something that very much frightens the disabled community, frankly.
All right, Brian, and I appreciate those comments. I'm actually very sensitive to persons with disabilities too, and I wouldn't think that Metro would be contra on that issue. But so I'm basically taking your concerns as and not in a conjecture as opposed to based on some set of facts or circumstances that you can report to the committee. Any other comments you want to make? I don't kind of cut you off here, but
no, that's fine.
All right, Senator Ringo.
I mean, I'll just make a comment. I think all of those are very legitimate concerns, and I can tell you, I represent Northwest Portland, and I have no interest in doing anything that's a disservice to Portland businesses or the people who live in Portland. But I think that Metro can be just as sensitive to all of these concerns as the Portland tax establishment. But they can do so also considering the needs of people who live out in the customers who live in the suburban areas and taxi companies that operate in suburban areas. So I don't think we're surrendering any of those things. And it seems to me at the heart, your concern is the uncertainty. Because right now you know what you've got. It's got some good, it's got some bad. And if you move to Metro, you're opening up some unknowns. But I don't think there's anything about the way Metro operates that makes us think that they're not concerned about ADA, they're not concerned about 4 a.m. airport rides, and that they wouldn't be able to accommodate all those concerns. I guess the
simplest maybe analogy that I could use would be that once again, if this thing is opened up,
Mr. Chair, again, this bill does not open it up. This bill does not. My thinking is that if Metro assumes responsibility, they're going to be very aware that too many permits are allocated in Portland, and then they're not going to open it up. Perhaps as the economy improves and as the population grows, then they're going to gradually accommodate regional needs. But I certainly don't envision, the floodgates are open and every taxi company in the entire metro area is suddenly going to be competing with you for business. And that would not be my intent, and I don't think Metro would do that.
Any other final comments?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, I believe Mark's comment about the concern and the fear that something beyond what the local needs have been established to be may be taken away. Maybe a valid fear. There's not the ability for a local jurisdiction here to have any regulation at all of that industry. And there are different needs in the different jurisdictions, and we've found that as we've dealt with Hillsborough and Lake Oswego and Wilsonville and Gresham and the cab companies here that are going to be speaking to you that serve those areas as well and have permits in those areas. So there are some of those legitimate concerns. Some of them revolve around the change in the cab industry that took place up in Seattle, where there was a marked change in the way that the cabs were regulated, and it has taken almost 10 years just to try to get back to where they were before they did, and there were unforeseen consequences. So,
well, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And let's see, we've got a panel of Ray Miles and Bob Wagner. I'm not sure if Michael Tolley is part of that panel also, but right, if you just introduce yourself for the record, and then I don't know who's going to go first or how you want to work this. But
I'll go first. Bob Wagner isn't here, but I'm Steve Entler. I'm from Radio Cab Company.
I'm sorry, you're Steve?
Steve Entler.
Entler?
Entler, yes.
Thank you.
I'm the general manager at Radio Cab Company in Portland, based in Northwest Portland. I think a lot of things have been hit on before, but I just wanted to raise our concerns personally. I mean, Radio Cab is an owner-operator-based company. All the drivers are individual businessmen, and they own the company themselves. And I represent probably a better part of 400 drivers that make their living, or try to make their living, off their individual cabs. And the concerns that we have are, you know, the degree of regulation that is about to be proposed. I mean, there really isn't enough said about it. One of the things that happens, or has happened historically over our long regulatory history, and when I say our, I mean the taxi industry in general, which dates back quite a few hundred years in one form or another, is that the densely populated areas tend to regulate to the maximum, and the less densely populated areas tend to just do the minimal type of regulation. Mainly their safety concerns and stuff of that nature. But the densely populated areas go all the way to the maximum amount of regulation, which is fare regulations and market entry concerns. And since it's not spelled out to the degree that Metro is going to involve itself, we're looking at Metro as a regional authority that's going to be concerned more with the overall area and not so concerned about this densely populated area that is Portland itself. City of Portland and their taxi board and the regulatory process have probably made some mistakes, and we've felt like at times we've been over-regulated to death, and more recently we've been under-regulated or under-enforced to the point where a good honest cab driver doesn't make a decent living. There are one or two of them left. Shifting the regulatory authority, we're not quite sure would solve that problem. It would probably add to it, if anything. I think the underlying intent of this whole thing is that some of the outlying cab companies can invade the Portland marketplace, which is going to dilute it out even further, which is going to kill off just that many more drivers. And we've already got enough transient drivers operating in the city that we just don't need more.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rigo.
I completely understand that that's your fear.
Yeah.
But, you know, look at this white paper that Metro did, and it talks about all the anomalies. What's that?
I haven't seen it.
Well, it's 2 years old.
Yeah.
It talks about the anomalies and the inefficiencies. You know, and even Dan Salzman's letter says to me, you know, the fact that a Beaverton taxi can go to the airport but can't take return fare, it's not only a detriment to business, but put pollutants in the air and miles travel on our roads for no good reason. And that's Dan Salzman. And so there's lots of other factors involved here other than just more competition for the Portland companies.
Well,
that's not the only the only issue.
Yeah. It's nice for him to look at it like that, but I have to look at it from Joe Blow cab driver's position, which is, oh my goodness, you know, see, first it was the SATs, then it was the executive car services, then it was this, and it was that. Now we get this little segment left, and by golly, somebody wants a chunk of that.
Steve, yeah. who owns Broadway Cab?
Or I don't know who owns Broadway Cab. Radio Cab's owned by all the drivers.
Radio Cab. Radio Cab's owned by all the drivers.
Yes.
Is there a holding company, or how does it work?
It's owned by the drivers. They're all stockholders in the company.
They're stock, so it's a stock-held company.
Yes.
And how's it organized?
Well, it's actually a C corporation, but it's structured very much like a cooperative. The only reason the company exists is to supply essential services to the drivers, which is insurance, dispatching, processing the charge business through the offices and things of that nature.
But each of the drivers is a stockholder in the C Corporation. Is that correct?
Yes. So if not every one of them. We do have some casual drivers too. But
you have what now?
We have some extra drivers, some lease drivers to fill in the owner operator's absence.
Are those persons employees?
They are independent contractors at this point. They were employees up until a year ago. I made the shift, but it was becoming uneconomically feasible.
Okay. So it's a C corporation owned by at least a percentage of the drivers.
A very large percentage.
And then there are independent contractors who also drive. And okay, I'm not going to get into why they're not employees as opposed to independent contractors, but okay, that helps me understand that. Okay, and Broadway Cab, how is it organized? Who owns it?
Broadway Cab's owned by a group of local investors in Portland.
Okay, and how is it organized?
It's a limited liability corporation.
It's an LLC, an Oregon LLC?
Yes.
All right. So that has a group of investors. The drivers are employees or independent contractors? Independent contractors. All right.
Mr. Chair, could she identify herself, please?
I don't
know who answered those questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm Ray Miles. I'm the chair of the company standing committee to the Private for Hire Transportation Board of Review and the general manager of Broadway Cab.
All right. We have been asking a lot of questions. We need to kind of redeem the time. I know you want to share something with us. So I assume we're going to you, right?
I do have a few comments. I actually had prepared some comments, but I'm going to kind of wing it and go in a little bit different direction. So,
okay.
Somebody I consider to be quite wise said to me once that, you know, right, ideas are cheap. It's follow-through that's expensive. And so my concerns with this concept are, Metro at this point really hasn't given us any indication how they would structure this, what they would do, what they would do in areas like accessibility, driver safety, that we really have been working pretty intently on. And, to be honest, and I'm not privy to a lot of Metro meetings, I don't have the contacts a lot of you have, I can't tell whether Metro wants this or not. And so I can appreciate the merits of the idea and the desire to sort of push it through in this manner. I'm just not sure, with all the other issues facing our region and facing our state, that this is going to get the kind of time and attention that I think it needs at this point in time. So, if Metro or really any other governing body stepped up with a plan that was thoughtful and deliberate and gave us some indication of the direction, I would gladly get behind it. I just don't think that exists at this point.
Mr. Senator, just to respond to that, of course it doesn't exist because it's so complicated. In some ways this is a chicken egg thing. I mean, do you need to have every piece in place before we're going to decide, oh, we better go to Metro? Because if you do have to have every piece in place, it's going to come under attack from anybody who thinks they might get the short end of a stick. And it just makes sense for Metro to, if you knew that in 2.5 years Metro was going to assume responsibility, everybody would start moving in that direction. And I guess I would also say that Doug Riggs is in the back, who represents Metro, and he'll say that they do not object to the bill. Frankly, I think it's a headache that they would be inheriting, and that's what government does. So Metro's fine with it.
Well,
and they're signed up to testify also.
In response to that, I don't think asking for a commitment to the existing companies who invested a lot of money and a commitment to the community of disabled persons, I don't think that's nitpicking. I don't think that's asking for a huge detailed plan at this point, but I do think there has been no indication of where they would go, how they view the economic balance that exists. I think one of the things that sometimes gets left out is, trips from Beaverton to the airport and from the airport back to Beaverton aren't hard to cover. Anybody will take those. One of the reasons that I think we regulate cab service is to ensure that the 8-block trip in Northeast Portland to get somebody to the pharmacy is as well covered as the $40 or $50 trip from Beaverton to the airport. That's what I think sometimes gets left out of the equation.
point. I guess in part I would agree with you too. Personally, I think cab service in Portland sucks, but you know, and I'm comparing that with Chicago and Washington D.C. and New York and places that I've been where cabs are in abundance. And I think in terms of regional transportation planning, I don't think we've done enough with cabs in terms of getting persons in and out of the city. You know, we've got that goofy light rail thing that's as slow as a centipede, stuffed in the morning, and you know, then all the gangbangers get on in the afternoon and ride, you know, out to Gresham or wherever. Seriously, I challenge you. You gotta ride a thing. It's the most disgusting thing at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I just don't think we've done enough with this, and I think there are a lot of opportunities with the cab industry, and you know, it's pretty limited right now. I just don't think they put their thinking caps on to figure out how they can get people in and out of the city in a reasonably inexpensive way, and I think there are lots of opportunities for cab drivers, but I think that sometimes the regulation just gets very, very narrow and very, very focused and doesn't think entrepreneurially, if you will. Mr. Tolley, you're here, and you want to share with us.
Yes, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Tolley. I'm a resident of Southwest Portland in Senator Burke's district. I've been a cab driver in Portland for 12 years, working for both radio and Broadway at different times. For three of those 12 years, I was the driver representative on the Taxi Cab Board of Review, representing 1,000 hardworking men and women who make their living in the for-hire transportation business. In addition to that, I've been asked to appear here today for Bob Wagner, who is the current driver representative, because he didn't feel that he could afford to take the time off because of the economy of the industry at the moment. Also, I wanted to clarify something. From September of last year until May 19th, I was an employee of the Legislative Assembly, Representative Nolan. I resigned my job with her a month ago because I felt so passionately about this bill and knew that the taxi industry needed a point person here to talk to members and to get our point across. One other clarification I'd like to make. Senator Ringo mentioned that he felt that a new item had been introduced to Senator Walker with the reference to cameras. That was new. I would dispute that. The eighth, although they're not numbered, the eighth bulleted item in my letter says long overdue safety standards about to be enacted by the City of Portland could be put on hold if the city believed that they would no longer be regulating taxis. And that was a specific reference to the outlay of money and that what's going to be a mechanical and bureaucratic nightmare to install that in 300 vehicles. I oppose this amendment because I think it's unwise, unwarranted, and unnecessary. It's a preemption of not only Portland, but Hillsborough's right to regulate businesses that operate in their cities. And a law should do more harm than good, and I don't believe that this passes that test. There's been no empirical evidence that this change...
Excuse me, Michael, I think you just screwed up here. I think you said the law should do more harm than good, and I'm not sure that's what you meant.
Oh, I thought I flipped that by now. Yes, you're right. There's been no empirical evidence presented that this change would benefit residents, either of Portland or the surrounding communities, the folks that visit us from around the world, or the 1,000 men and women who depend on this industry to make their living. No study has been done, no plan presented, no survey conducted, no proposed regulatory package presented, no market entry requirements suggested. All this without any request from any of the 23 cities that are in Metro's boundaries or the three counties that this should be undertaken. The public hasn't demanded it, the industry doesn't want it, the drivers haven't asked for it, and there's no proven need for it. Although I agree with Senator Ringo that this is probably something that should be addressed, to have it forced on the city, or any of the cities, when Metro already has the right to assume taxi regulation if they wanted to, and the City of Portland and Metro could sit down and work this out together. But to have the legislature come and say, we don't like the way you are doing this, and we'd like you to do it differently, seems to be sort of a slap at the city. And I share Mark's concerns about accessible transportation for the disabled, and the, as I mentioned, the overdue safety requirements for drivers, and the supply-demand imbalance. I just really think that this is an idea that should be discussed more. I mean, we're talking about changing 50 years of regulations after a two-hour hearing, and I think Metro and the city and other cities sitting down together would be a better way to go.
So, Michael, let me ask you this question. What's the purpose for government regulation of taxi cabs? What's the purpose?
The if you don't mind a historical reference,
no,
the first taxi cab regulations were put into place in London in 1542, and it had to do with how crowded the streets had become and the leavings of the taxis. Part of there are several regulatory schemes that are
used. I'm wondering what the general purpose is. Why would government regulate free enterprise? So I look at cab companies, it's free enterprise capitalism, and I always have a problem with government intruding into free enterprise capitalism, except that it have a specific and reasonable purpose for doing so. So what would that reasonable purpose be?
One is to ensure that the vehicles are safe,
all right,
for the passengers and
vehicles
the driver
safe
as well.
Okay.
That they are covered by insurance, that it is adequate for any problems that might develop.
Okay, sure.
There's also, by limiting the number of vehicles.
Now you're treading on the free enterprise issue.
I feel free to tread
on thin ice with me when you get to that point.
Okay.
So.
The reason is that if there is an overabundance of taxis on the street, as one of the previous witnesses said, drivers tend to take chances. They drive too fast. They tend to engage in price gouging because they're just not making. There's a certain limited pool of trips available. And if that pool has been determined to be best covered by 400 vehicles, and then you just throw that number out and allow 600 or 700 vehicles, people are working longer hours, they get tired, they take unnecessary chances. I've often said...
But wouldn't the free market take care of that? I mean, wouldn't you have a hard time staying in business if you...
But, Senator, if the free market... if the driver who is trying to make money to feed his three kids and pay his rent and his utility bills has worked 18 hours and drives up on the sidewalk and kills three people, that's not really, you know, good for anybody. And that's where some of this comes from, that you regulate how many hours drivers can work, just like they do in the trucking industry. You regulate what they can charge people for the services, and... you know, we could easily have 382 cabs with 382 pricing schemes.
I might understand the pricing scheme issue so you're not gouging customers that we tend to understand. But
you want to get, Senator, you and your wife go downtown for dinner and you take a cab home, perhaps. I hope you would consider doing that anyway.
We're not taking light rail.
Okay.
Unless I'm armed.
You'd like to know that the driver has... you know, is a safe driver, that the vehicle's safe, that he hasn't been working for 16 or 17 hours, and that he didn't turn the meter on, you know, 8 blocks before it picked you up. So although I would feel, you know, that I could function better without so many regulations, I appreciate them. It makes me keep the car clean and the tires changed, and I'm not the type that would, you know, gouge customers, but, you know, he has parameters to work within, and I think it's better for the public at large, and especially when you bring people from out of town, it forms an impression on your city.
All right, I have to wind this up. I know senators have been patient with me here, allowing this thing to go as long as it has. We'll bring this back at some other point. At this juncture, I'm tending to favor legislation.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank all the Portland taxi folks for coming and expressing their views. I am very much willing to try to address their concerns on this, but I do want to thank you for taking time.
I appreciate your testimony also. And if you want additional comments submitted, you can submit them to the committee. We'll add them to the record. All right. For that, we're going to be adjourned.